Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, Illinois lawmakers voted this year to legalize recreational marijuana. On a national level, that was monumental for those pushing for similar laws across the country. We'll explain and hear what other changes they want Illinois to make. A new survey finds Governor J.B. Pritzker's approval rating at about 60%, but there's still a lot of pessimism about the state and the direction things are headed.
A very clear majority say things are not going in the right direction, and yet Governor Pritzker gets a pretty strong approval rating.
Questions are being raised about Illinois Supreme Court Justice and her politically connected husband. We'll have a report on that. And we'll also learn about an East Coast reporter who wrote a cynical story about a small rural town that he visited and liked it so much, he moved there. That and much more on this week's Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, concerns over keeping diversity among the teacher ranks, some ideas of what Illinois can do about it, and Illinois' new marijuana law, how it's been viewed nationally. That and more this hour on Statewide. First up this week here on Statewide, a survey from NPR Illinois and the University of Illinois Springfield questioned more than 1,000 registered voters across the state, and it asked some key questions to get views on the economy, elected officials, and the overall direction of Illinois. Brian Mackey is NPR Illinois State House editor. He joins me to break down some of the numbers. And Brian, let's start with the man at the top, Governor J.B. Pritzker. He's been in office less than a year. Most voters say they support the job he's doing so far.
Yes, voters seem to have a pretty positive feeling, at least in this snapshot survey. They gave him a 59% approval rating. He's above water, so to speak, above 50% in all age groups. Most popular, as you might expect, among young people, people who live in Cook County, and those who identify as Black or Latino.
Brian, this is a governor who's not been allergic to the idea of more taxes. He's pushed for some of that. He's had some controversial policies that he's pushed through as well. A little surprising that his approval rating is as high as it is.
Yeah, and I guess it's not so much the policies that he's pushed through that surprises me. It's the other polling questions. There was a question about, well, how do you feel about the Illinois economy? Would you describe it as great? You know, fair, poor, good, just good. And it turns out that the vast majority of Illinoisans, something about 77%, would rate the Illinois economy as fair at best or poor. Just 4% think it's excellent, 19% think it's good. So you have this pretty pessimistic view of the Illinois economy. And then there's this classic polling question. Do you think Illinois is going in the right direction or is it on the wrong track? And 56% of voters say it's on the wrong track. Just 28% say it's on the right direction. So a very clear majority say things are not going in the right direction. And yet Governor Pritzker gets a pretty strong approval rating. I think some of that could be pent-up demand for a functional government in Springfield, even if people don't like what the government is doing in terms of legalizing marijuana for recreational use, passing legislation to add protections for access to reproductive health services and abortion, or some of the other things they've been doing, pushing through a change to that could allow the state to have a graduated income tax instead of its flat tax. At least something is happening. And I think for people who maybe aren't as invested in the day-to-day of politics, they see a lot of news stories, things are getting done in Springfield. And if you think back, certainly that wasn't the case during much of the Rauner administration. There was a lot of consternation and gridlock during the Quinn administration. And we can all remember the Blagojevich administration didn't go very well. For better or worse, I think you can argue that Illinois government hasn't been this active since going back to the 1990s and the turn of the century under Governor George Ryan and before.
Well, not everybody's a fan of Governor Pritzker at this point, including many Republicans, but still about half of those who said they are Republican or lean Republican seem to be also on board that they thought he was doing a good job at this point.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think this is a question of Governor Rauner certainly did not endear himself to the core base of Republican voters. And I think that he also alienated a lot of moderates. So the core base, they didn't appreciate that the budget impasse eventually led to a tax increase. And then probably most importantly, that he signed an expansion of abortion rights and allowed for public funding of abortion for people on state or university health insurance and women in the Medicaid program. But then, you know, moderates were alienated by the budget impasse and is sort of insistent on his way or the highway approach, at least in the political classes that was the case. I'm not sure how much that particular concern went out to the mass of voters. But it is an interesting result. And, you know, to the extent that this poll is accurate, and we have to say every poll is just a snapshot in time, but to the extent this one is accurate, it suggests that Governor Pritzker has enjoyed some pretty significant popularity, at least at this point in his first year of his freshman term.
You mentioned the graduated income tax. That's one of the governor's ideas to help get Illinois back on track, as you would say. It would take voters approving that idea next fall because it would change the state's constitution. And we're going to hear a lot more about this over the next several months. But as of now, according to this survey, there does seem to be some strong support for it.
There does. Overall, support was 67%. Of people who support this concept of a graduated income tax. That number tracks pretty closely with what other polls have found, particularly the Simon poll at Southern Illinois University's Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. They've found that 66-70% area of support for the graduated income tax going back more than a decade. So this is something that has tracked for a long time. It's as you would expect, an idea that is most popular with Democrats, but there is also Republican support, not a majority, but fully 49% of Republicans actually would be willing to at least somewhat support the concept of a graduated income tax. There was also some confusion, though, in the poll about there was an interesting question about, do you think you personally would pay more? And I think a surprisingly high number of people think they would pay more, even those at the lower end of the income spectrum, whereas the governor's message and how he's pushing this is that only the top 3% of income earners, people who make $250,000 and above, would see a tax increase under his plan. Everybody else will either stay the same or get a slight tax decrease.
Well, one of the things we've been hearing a lot about over the last few years has been people saying they're moving out of state or going to move out of state. This survey asked some questions regarding that, and what did we find out?
Yeah, that was not a good, not a feel-good answer, because fully 3 people out of 5 say that in the last year they've thought about leaving the state. But then the pollsters did something I thought was interesting here, because it's easy to say, oh, yeah, I want to move out of Illinois. I think a lot of us have heard friends say, if so-and-so wins the presidency, I'm moving to Canada. You know, it's easy to say that. But the pollsters wanted to gauge how serious people were about moving away. So they asked some follow-up questions. Did you apply for a job out of state? Did you even look at housing in another state, let alone apply for housing? Did you tell your friends and family you were going to move away? And for each of those questions, at most, just a quarter of the people who said they wanted to leave had actually taken any concrete steps. And for some of those, like actually applying for a job, it was a much smaller number of people. But I do think that when 3 out of 5 people are willing to say they've thought about moving away, that there's no way to put a positive spin on that. Then it's also interesting, there was a question about why they wanted to leave. Lower state tax rates was a big reason, the biggest reason. State government was a popular choice, followed by better weather.
Well, Brian, before I let you go, looking at some of these results, we have heard pushback on this survey from some people who feel that the partisan breakdown skewed too heavily Democratic. What did the pollster have to say?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think people are misreading what the universe of people is. So it says 53% Democratic, 30% Republican. That's how people are characterizing it. But in fact, it's 53% people who are Democrats, or say they're an independent, but they lean Democratic, or they're a Republican or an independent who leans Republican. So you get a lot of people in these polls who say, in the classic way of doing it, you say, are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? If they say independent, that's that. You mark independent. But we know from political science research that most people who say they're independents really have partisan leanings, but for whatever reason, maybe their personality or whatever reason, they don't want to come out and say, yes, I'm a Democrat, I'm a Republican. And so this pollster tries to push people a little bit more. And so, you know, okay, if you're not a Democrat, do you lean Democratic or Republican? And then you can get people to say, yes, they lean one way or the other. And so if you take that out and you do it the kind of old-fashioned way of just Democrat, Republican, Independent, it shows that in this universe, the Illinois Democrats have a 16-point advantage on the Republicans, which is pretty consistent with a lot of other polls in the past here. But the pollster's thought is that you get a more accurate snapshot of voters and partisan leanings if you actually kind of push people to take a stand one way or another. In a way, it's kind of like what we were talking about with the are you really leaving Illinois? It's easy for people to say one thing, and you want to try and dig a little bit deeper to get them to stake out and get what their true views really are.
That's Brian Mackey. He's NPR Illinois State House Editor, and we have more to come from the NPR Illinois University of Illinois Springfield survey in coming days. We do have a link at what's been released so far at our website, statewideshow.com. In Illinois, students of color comprise more than half of the school population, but their teachers are overwhelmingly white. And even when schools recruit and hire teachers of color, they tend to leave the profession much faster than their white colleagues. A recent report took a look at what schools can do to encourage Black and Latinx teachers to stay. Our education reporter Dusty Rhodes has more.
The report comes from an organization called Teach Plus. It's a nonprofit that trains classroom teachers to become leaders in education policy. I had a long phone interview with one of the report's authors, Corey Winchester, an award-winning history and sociology teacher at Evanston Township High School. Here's an excerpt of our chat.
The efforts that go into recruitment, I think, are actually pretty vast. And if you don't have a plan in place to actually retain who you're recruiting, then there's no point of recruiting at all.
And it's not enough to just say, well, hey, we're giving you a paycheck.
Oh, yeah, that is not the end all be all for most folks. You know, I think, you know, at least when I went into education, I surely did not do it for the paycheck. You know, it was because I realized that, you know, opportunities presented to people like me in educational spaces, you know, were rarities and few and far between. You know, folks of color aren't supposed to be successful in schools. That's by design. So I think a lot of educators of color who decide to go into the classroom do so because they're looking to shake up the system to not just survive, but to thrive.
But compensation is a major factor. The Teach Plus report drew on suggestions from focus groups, and Winchester says financial protections were a top recommendation.
You know, folks of color enter educational spaces, you know, with that vacuum that has been created by, you know, years and years of systemic and institutional racism. So when we go to school is expensive, and then we get, you know, these jobs that sometimes aren't sustainable given the amount of work that we do as educators of color. So if there were some loan forgiveness programs or, you know, special scholarships or different repayment incentives to keep us in the classroom, I think that would be important. One of the other things that becomes a part of this, you know, we call it an invisible tax, is some of the systemic pressures that are placed on us when our white colleagues fail to, you know, realize the ways that they contribute to unsafe working environments for us, when district leaders, you know, don't recognize that. So we want to make sure that there are professional development experiences for, you know, district leaders to improve their cultural competency in working with staff of color. You know, the microaggressions that I think we sometimes face, you know, can be easily reduced if some of our, you know, white colleagues were more conscious of how they existed in spaces in relation to us.
Part of that invisible tax is the casual handoff of crisis aversion duties. Here's how that works. Statewide, fewer than 15% of our teachers are people of color, but their ability to connect with students of color is so recognizable, they frequently get asked to intervene with students who may not even be in their classrooms.
Folks have spoken anecdotally about, you know, being the one person of color, the one black person, the one, you know, Latinx person. You know, when there's an issue with a student who shares that identity, who do they come to? Say, oh, you know, I think you might be able to connect with this student. Right. That shouldn't fall on our shoulders. You should be able to figure out your own stuff, given your identities about why you're not connecting with our students, and then make sure that that happens. Don't use my existence solely because you haven't done the work to figure out yours. We're not going to say no because those are our kids. But also you have to do your due diligence to make sure that you've checked yourself, that you've exhausted all the resources, and that when you do come to us, you say, here are all the things that I've done. Here are the ways that I've tried to support. And I really, you know, I don't know. I've talked to X person, Y person, D person. You know, I've talked to parents, and I'm really trying to figure out what I can do. I'm at my wit's end, and I'm actually coming to you because I don't know what to do. That's a whole different story.
But here's the thing. Those interventions usually don't translate into systemic changes. That frustrates teachers of color, sometimes to the point that they leave. In the Teach Plus report, they say they're more likely to stay in a school where their own advocacy and initiatives on behalf of students are welcomed and encouraged. They spell it out right in the title of the report. If you listen, we will stay.
What we're looking for is to make sure that we don't feel invisible in the space, which is something that happens often. You know, we don't want to feel undervalued because we realize that there are additional aspects of our work that fall on our shoulders. You know, we want to make sure that we feel agency and autonomy to do work.
Winchester says this effort cannot be just a box the district board checks off. Retaining teachers of color requires full focus.
Your systems have to change fundamentally. Like, that has to be, you know, at the center of what you do. If it's not at the center, you're only going to continue to replicate the status quo. So if you want your spaces to be, you know, great for teachers of color to flourish, then everything has to work towards that.
Reporting for Statewide, I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Stay with us here on Statewide. Next, a closer look at Illinois' soon-to-be Chief Justice and some questions that are being raised. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, there's been a lot of controversy surrounding a new shelter and clinic for the homeless in Springfield. We'll hear from a woman who runs a ministry in the city that tries to help the homeless. Later, even reporters make mistakes. One called a Midwestern community the worst place to live. But he's now changed his mind and moved his family there. That and more, still on the way this hour. Ann Burke becomes the Illinois Supreme Court's Chief Justice later this month. She's long been part of Chicago's most influential political power couple, along with her husband, Alderman Ed Burke. The alderman now faces federal corruption charges. But Justice Burke's tenure on the state's high court generally has been free of controversy. And now an investigation by member station WBEZ finds several cases that Ann Burke heard on the Supreme Court, even though they involve clients of her husband's law firm. As Dave McKinney reports, that's raising questions about Illinois' judicial ethics system.
Ann Burke joined the Supreme Court in 2006 with a promise to be one of its most transparent members. Here she is on the day she was appointed.
I'm constantly on the lookout for any possible, what appears to be, which I might not even think, is an appearance of impropriety or conflict. I go the opposite way.
Since then, justices have handed down more than 900 opinions, and I've read them all. And one of them led me to a neatly kept ranch house in Northwest Suburban Des Plaines.
Hi, I'm Dave McKinney. I'm with WBEZ.
Yeah, Dave, how are you? I'm Gene. Gene Zelinda.
Gene, it's a pleasure.
I met a family caught up in a legal matter that Justice Burke ruled on. While the company involved was one of the biggest clients of her husband's longtime former property tax appeal firm. What you're hearing is the sound of 42-year-old Jason Sloan breathing through his ventilator. Jason lives with his parents. He has a rare condition that leaves him without the impulse to breathe. He also has developmental disabilities. His entire life, he's been attached to the ventilator 24 hours a day.
You can say hi. You can say anything.
You have to
anything.
Talk louder.
You have to talk louder. You want to talk in the microphone?
Hi.
That's Jason and his mom, Deborah Sloan. Jason likes the action movie Top Gun. He watches it every day. And he proudly displays a plastic tub of superhero figures. Batman is his favorite. In 2007, storms knocked out power to the family's house for days. Jason's mom and dad had to move him out of the house so he wouldn't suffocate.
When that power goes out, there's a hole in his throat with the tube. Everything shuts down. So hold your breath. Tell me how long you think you can hold your breath. That's what he has to experience.
The family is on a life support registry that lets the electric company, Commonwealth Edison, know that Jason is highly vulnerable to power interruptions. Despite his condition, the family says ComEd was dismissive when bad weather knocked out their power in 2007 and didn't prioritize them when it was being restored. So they joined a class action lawsuit against the utility, and it went all the way to the Illinois Supreme Court. Ultimately, Ann Burke and the court's six other justices sided with ComEd. The thing is, when she participated in that case, ComEd was a client of her husband's boutique law firm. It's one of at least 10 examples WBEZ found in which Justice Burke was sitting in judgment on a case involving her husband's clients, as those same clients were paying Alderman Burke's firm for unrelated legal matters. Three involved ComEd, but they also included banks, a shopping mall, a big Chicago landlord, and a prominent downtown hospital. That connection was news to Deborah Sloan and her husband, Eugene Zielinski.
Do both of you believe she should have recused herself in this case?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Tell me why.
Because her husband's law firm was representing ComEd. Maybe it wasn't on this particular case, but that has no bearing. Your client is your client. ComEd is still his client. So she's married to him.
A Supreme Court spokesman says Justice Burke was unaware ComEd was a client of her husband's firm when she heard that case, and she doesn't even know who the firm's clients are. Burke herself declined WBEZ's interview requests to explain her participation in cases like this. But public records show that Alderman Burke's law firm, which specializes in local property tax appeals, helped ComEd save big money. More than $4 million in property tax bills that were cut over the last decade. A ComEd spokeswoman says that that's why they hired Alderman Burke's firm, to save customers money, not to curry favor with his wife in an unrelated case. Last year alone, ComEd paid the firm more than $100,000. It won't say how much it paid in previous years. Now, to be clear, there's no evidence Justice Burke ever swung a case to benefit her husband's clients. But the Burke's unique situation is raising concerns from some legal experts.
No one thing strikes me as a smoking gun that leads you to say, aha, here's the wrongdoing.
Charles Gardner Jay teaches law at Indiana University, and he's a national expert on judicial ethics.
But collectively, something smells a bit fishy.
There's nothing in the public record to explain why Ann Burke did or did not participate in certain cases involving her husband's clients. But it's clear Justice Burke is no stranger to recusing herself. Of the more than 900 cases WBEZ analyzed, she chose not to participate in 45 of them. That's more than double any other justice. A court spokesman attributes some of those recusals to cases that came through a state appeals court she served on. The Supreme Court does have rules about recusal, but there's room for interpretation. They say a justice must step away from a case if their spouse has an economic interest in a party before the court. Judges must also make a, quote, reasonable effort to keep informed about the personal economic interest of the judge's spouse.
I don't think Justice Burke would be required to disqualify herself in cases where Clafter and Burke represent a client in an unrelated matter.
That's Northwestern University law professor Stephen Lubet. He says Ed Burke's law firm did not have a financial interest in ComEd's case before the Supreme Court, and so
there would be no reason to think that a justice would be other than impartial because her husband's law firm is involved in some unrelated litigation.
But the top ethics watchdog for the city of Chicago says it might be time to revisit what he regards as vague judicial ethics rules. Chicago Inspector General Joe Ferguson wouldn't comment on Ann Burke's conduct specifically, but he compares the existing self-policing recusal system to a windowless room where the public can't see in.
The institution as a whole really has to question whether or not their standards and transparency are sufficient to overcome the questions that almost inevitably are going to arise in a situation like this.
Ferguson says Illinois' court system is inherently political. So he questions how smart it is to have lax rules that give judges like Ann Burke little explicit guidance about what constitutes a conflict. And Ferguson says he can understand why someone like Deborah Sloan and her husband would feel like they didn't get a fair hearing at the Supreme Court.
It's not surprising at all. That's where we are, unfortunately, as a society. And that's what our standards should be responsive to right now.
If those court rules governing transparency are ever going to get a serious overhaul, the final sign-off could only come from one place: Ann Burke and the Illinois Supreme Court's six other justices. This is Dave McKinney.
Helping Hands of Springfield has ended its effort to open a shelter and medical clinic for the city's homeless. Some community members say they're worried about what that decision could mean for the capital city. Julie Becker runs Helping the Homeless in Springfield, a ministry which delivers blankets, clothes, and food throughout the city. Becker spoke to our reporter Daisy Contreras about her work and her reflections on the Center for Health and Housing project.
What has been the response or the reaction from the people that you help after finding out that this wasn't going to happen for them?
Well, it's another disappointment in their life. You know, many of them had looked forward to getting the proper medical services and housing. I know that there are people that are doing this on their own. It is a struggle to try to sleep on the street and then go to your job the next day. You got to have your clothes cleaned. You got to have you've got to be able to bathe, be presentable for your employer. And then, you know, so I know three people that got off the street. I know three more people that are back on the street. This cycle is going to continue until we do something serious like the Center for Health and Housing.
What are the solutions now? I mean, now with that project off the table, Helping Hands says they are going to extend some of their services as much as they can. The cold days are upon us, and you have your work cut out for you. What would you like your elected officials here in town to do about this?
I want somebody to make a decision. I want the mayor to make a decision and move forward and let the people who are on the negative side of this see that this can work. I know that we had 8 aldermen vote for the center. The mayor was, it looked like he was going to go for it, and then the opposition spoke up. I don't know where he's at now. I would like to challenge him to come out with me for a couple of days and see how it is that these people live. Weather is coming. It's October. It's cold. It's going to be 70 degrees today, but it gets down to 40. I want him to understand how crucial this is to help people. They're human beings.
Right now we're meeting at a place where you get to store the donations that people give to you so that you can provide those to people out in the streets. You start your morning here. What do you do after?
I start getting phone calls and texts at, you know, 6:10 in the morning until 8:30 or 9 o'clock at night, sometimes later, depending on what the weather is. People want blankets. They want sleeping bags. Now they're wanting coats. They're wanting hooded sweatshirts. You know, I'm going to be gathering gloves. People need to eat, so I take smaller food baskets to the people on the street because it's heavy for them to carry. They've already got enough to carry: a blanket, a book bag, a coat. Every day, almost every day, I get someone new who's reaching out to me. Oh, Miss Julie, somebody told me about you. I need this. I need that. Can you help me? Socks is a big thing. Pretty soon we're going to be giving them thicker socks. Shoes. They walk a lot. So I'm getting requests for tennis shoes right now. Pretty soon it's going to be boots. Obviously, this is a daily thing. I do this 7 days a week, sometimes 12 hours a day. There is no stopping the help. But if we could get people into housing, the needs would be different. People would be calling me, asking me for a microwave or some pots and pans or maybe a little bit of food to get by because their link isn't enough. This building was going to be an answer for a lot of things. It wasn't going to be perfect. Nothing is perfect, but it was going to be better than what we've got now.
Julie, I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was reporter Daisy Contreras speaking to Julie Becker of Helping the Homeless in Springfield. Rural hospitals are closing at record rates these days, and reproductive health care is often the first to go when providers cut costs. But with more women raising livestock and spraying chemicals, Harvest Public Media's Christina Stella reports some want to see a stronger focus on women's health care.
On a crisp fall day in northeastern Nebraska, Dr. Bailey Lammers, a livestock veterinarian, is on her way to a house call for some calves.
So we're going to go vaccinate some new heifers, so they're going to be bred next year.
A group of Auburn cattle greet her at the pasture gate, peering from behind the dirt-caked bars. A year and a half ago, a routine job like vaccination would have been much more fraught. Lammers and Kaylin were both pregnant.
It did make me nervous because there's definitely more hands-on in a smaller operation like this.
Lammers found herself second-guessing some of the ways she was used to working. Other times, pregnancy safety risks weren't as obvious, like when pouring chemicals to keep livestock free of bugs.
You know, I think I was early on in my pregnancy, and I think my glove had ripped, and usually I wouldn't worry about that, and I would just keep moving and not want to stop progress. And then it all of a sudden dawned on me that was not just for me anymore.
Dealing with harsh chemicals and germy livestock are the reality of working in agriculture. But less is known about how hazards can impact a woman's reproductive health, especially while pregnant.
There is some research out there. However, having that solid link is still difficult.
That's Linda Emanuel. She's a community health nurse with AgriSafe, a nonprofit that offers safety training and health services to producers. She's also Dr. Lammers' aunt.
There has been some links found for some females that increased chance of miscarriages and increased chance of lower fertility rates.
And working with livestock while pregnant can be extra dangerous. Accidentally sticking yourself with a needle full of hormones, that can trigger an abortion. Plus, animals carry bacteria and illnesses that can threaten pregnancies.
In human medicine, you know, when you're dealing with patients, it's like common nature. Yeah, I put the gloves on, I put the mask on when I need to. People don't always think that way when they're dealing with livestock.
Emanuel says many women in ag don't know how to work safely until it's too late. Lammers remembers her own scare well.
I had a herd of heifers that was aborting their babies late term, and so I went out to see what was going on.
Typically, she'd do an autopsy. She was nervous, but wanted to do her job as usual.
And I accidentally had nicked part of the stomach, and the stomach kind of, lack of better words, blew up in my face, and so I was exposed to whatever was in there.
A sample later tested positive for Campylobacter, a bacteria known to cause pregnancy complications and sometimes trigger miscarriages. Lammers called her OBGYN, but the doctor didn't know what to tell her. She wasn't trained in livestock exposure.
It's not a really common thing to say, hey, I blew up a rumen of a cow all over my face, and this is the bacteria it has. What do you think? I mean, it's not something they deal with every day.
Lammers was grateful for any access to an OB when she needed it. For many women, there is no doctor to call. Since 2010, 134 rural hospitals have shut down their OB units, and 18 have closed entirely. Now, less than half of rural hospitals in the U.S. still provide reproductive care. Jordan Rasmussen is a healthcare advocate at the Center for Rural Affairs. She says stories like Lammers are symptoms of an overwhelmed and under-resourced rural healthcare system.
It's a challenge to go to your general practitioner for just a cold sometimes. I mean, our doctors are unfortunately stretched thin. They don't necessarily have that opportunity to specialize in some of those areas or be able to even do the research.
In the end, Lammers and her baby were okay, but the experience stuck with her aunt Emmanuel.
It was an aha moment. Ag medicine is somewhat new, and people just don't understand that study and focus. And that includes healthcare providers. Unless a physician grew up in a farming community, then they understand. Agriculture is its own culture.
When Lammers gets pregnant again, she knows to ask for help and will wear more protective gear. She thinks safety awareness will increase as it becomes more normal for women to work in agriculture.
I think for the most part, especially younger generations, understand that there's a lot more women in agriculture in general. now seeing them in the tractor out there pushing cows, it's not so weird anymore.
And she feels excited for that change, even if it does mean investing in some goggles. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up, we'll talk about marijuana legalization in Illinois and on a national level, more of statewide, just ahead. This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And remember, our website is statewideshow.com. Links to all the stories you hear each week can be found there. Still on the way, how a rural town changed a reporter's mind. We'll hear more. That's coming up on Statewide. Starting January 1st, recreational cannabis will be legal in Illinois. A leading national advocacy group touts Illinois' law as the top legislative accomplishment on the issue for 2019. Karen O'Keefe is director of state policies with the Marijuana Policy Project, and I had a chance to speak with her.
Illinois passing adult use marijuana legalization was groundbreaking. It was the first state legislature that has ever legalized marijuana, including regulated sales. Every other state that passed a comprehensive marijuana legalization bill did through the voter initiative process. So it was voters themselves that took that step. In Vermont, the legislature approved possession and cultivation of marijuana, but they didn't take the sales of marijuana off the illicit market. So this was the first time ever. It's also something that most states, the only way that most states are able to legalize marijuana would be through the legislature, because most states don't have a voter initiative process. So it started a new wave of this being a way that states can legalize marijuana.
And from your group's standpoint, does that really matter a lot as long as the end result, you know, is what you hope it will be? Does it really matter if it's through the voters or through the legislature? What would be the difference there?
The difference is that most states just don't have a ballot initiative process. So I believe only 23 states have a voter initiative process. So if we're going to make marijuana legal in all 50 states, the only way to do it in about half of those states is if legislatures choose to do so. And that includes a lot of deep blue states as well as a lot of red states. So states like New York, Maryland, Delaware, Connecticut, and New Jersey, none of those have the options of citizens collecting signatures and putting something on the ballot. So really the only way to make what voters want a reality is for legislatures to do so. And we've seen the Gallup poll shows two-thirds support among voters for making marijuana legal. Elected officials have just really lagged behind the population in marijuana policy. And this is true both for medical marijuana and for adult use marijuana. And so we're finally starting to see lawmakers catch up. It's been six and a half years since the first state voters approved legalization, so it's taken some time for elected officials to follow suit, but it's really encouraging, and we've had, even though none of the other laws passed, there's been a lot of movement that's brought the day closer that other states will also be legalizing marijuana through their legislatures.
Well, you mentioned that timetable. I remember talking back when the first state started to do this, and it was talking to a State House reporter and another watcher here in Illinois, someone who has a pretty good handle on the pulse of the state, and he thought then it could be as long as 2025 before we would see marijuana become legal here in Illinois. What changed to move that timetable up?
Well, there are a number of factors. I think that a lot of people didn't know what to expect when Colorado first made marijuana legal. It wasn't clear that the federal government would back off and let states make their own decision without actually raiding and prosecuting people, because this is all still federally illegal. It also wasn't clear, you know, a lot of people had concerns that teen marijuana use would go up or that there would be more high school dropouts. And actually, teens are using marijuana at no higher rate. In Colorado, it's actually a slightly lower rate than they were before. So I think there's just been enough time to really take a deep dive and to look at what's happening and see that this is something that the states can regulate and can do in a way that benefits the population, that makes sure cannabis consumers have a safe, tested product, to make sure that the state can control where, when, and to whom cannabis is sold. And the states can bring in hundreds of millions of dollars every year in tax revenue that can be invested in things that people care about, things like schools and Medicaid funding. And in Illinois' law, a quarter of the funding is going to go to communities that have been disinvested in and that have been hard hit by the war on drugs.
Now, of course, you see states in some cases here in Illinois, it has been discussed for a number of years, and we had the medical marijuana program that predates this new law that took effect. But is there a possibility states could move too fast, maybe roll out programs, not having done the prep work that's needed? Is there any concern over that?
There might be people who have that concern, but it's been 6.5 years since Colorado and Washington made marijuana legal, so there's been plenty of time to see what's working and what hasn't. I know in Illinois, the bill sponsor spent about 2 years crafting their program, making sure that all of the stakeholders had a chance to have a voice, listening to regulators from Colorado and other states and to see what's worked and what maybe could be tweaked. So at this point, I think there's more of a concern that people will stall. You know, we've had the same people in some states being said, don't rush it for 5 years. At the point you're saying, don't rush it for 5 years, it's not being rushed. It's being delayed. And every year it's delayed, we have people whose lives are being destroyed because they're getting caught up in the criminal justice system. They're sometimes involved in violence. When marijuana is sold on the illicit market, both people selling it and buying it are at risk of theft and robbery and other violence.
From your group's standpoint and the legislation that passed here in Illinois, you mentioned all the time that that was put into getting the idea out there and negotiating with people. In the end of the day, there were still some people not happy with the end result, maybe issues like home grow. Are those some things that you'd still like to see Illinois deal with in the coming months, in the coming years?
Certainly. Two of the big things that we were hoping to see included in the law that weren't are home delivery and home cultivation. For everything else, you know, people are used to buying things from Amazon and having even prescription medicines can be delivered to your door. But with cannabis, that's not included in the law. And it's something that employers are still able to punish people for possessing marijuana. There's still some stigma because of federal law. So people like the discretion of being able to, you know, just have it delivered to their home, and it also saves time and energy, especially if some cities ban marijuana stores and you have to drive a couple hours to get cannabis. So we do think it's important to allow home delivery. We also think adults in every single state can brew their own beer. They should also be able to grow securely a small number of plants. We were glad that the law that passed allowed at least seriously ill patients to grow medical cannabis, but we do hope that next year they'll go ahead and improve the law in those two ways.
Your latest report takes a look across the country at marijuana legislation and both successes and maybe not so much here in the past year, but what else is really happening around the country right now? Is it a situation where most states are at least considering this idea?
Every state just about has some kind of activity on whether it's medical marijuana expansion, decriminalizing cannabis, or refining existing laws. There were literally hundreds of bills that passed that were considered and dozens of bills that passed in this past legislative session. Three states, Hawaii, North Dakota, and New Mexico, decriminalized simple possession, meaning a person will not go to jail for a small amount of cannabis. A number of states like New Hampshire and Washington have expungement that they added to existing laws to make it easier for people to wipe out past criminal records for possessing marijuana. A lot of states expanded their medical marijuana conditions. And one thing that's notable is that no state had a serious move to repeal either medical marijuana or legalization. I think in the entire country, there was one lawmaker that put in a bill that would ask voters to repeal a law that 66% had just approved in Missouri, and it didn't get out of committee. So the fact that no one's really looking at rolling back these laws just gives you some indication of just how popular they are and the fact that they aren't causing problems.
When you look at a state like Illinois, a Midwestern state, some may call it an outlier when it comes to the politics of the state of Illinois compared to its neighbors, but do you often see that when a state like Illinois takes this type of action to legalize marijuana, do you see a ripple effect next door that we might see in the next couple of years?
Not sure if it'll ripple next door, but nationwide, I think the more states that move forward, and especially the more states that are seen as kind of middle America, the more other states feel comfortable following suit. Of course, Michigan, the voters in Michigan passed a law back last year before Illinois, so we've got two Midwestern states now that have passed legalization laws. And I do think that we're going to see more lawmakers and more voters have comfort the more they see other states move forward and the sky not falling.
Well, the state's taking action. That's a piecemeal approach. Of course, you'd like to probably see laws changed at the federal level. How is that going?
So we've seen more activity in U.S. Congress this year than ever before. The There was a historic hearing in the House Judiciary Committee on how to end marijuana prohibition. That had never happened before. The House of Representatives included a rider that would say that none of the money appropriated to the Justice Department could be used to interfere in legalization laws. That was the first time that ever included that rider. And so we're starting to see a lot of discussion and movement. Congress is way behind voters on this. The Senate doesn't look like it's likely to pass anything broad. I think at the most we can probably hope for in the next year or two, what Trump has said he would sign is the States Act that would remove federal penalties from state legal activity. But the fact that we're even talking about that and that there's anything under serious consideration in Congress is a great thing. And it's also encouraging that a number of members of Congress are proposing bills that would look at the racial disparities in marijuana arrests and look to also expunge past convictions in addition to making marijuana legal.
That's Karen O'Keefe, Director of State Policies for the Marijuana Policy Project. We spoke a few weeks ago, and since then another action in Congress made news. The U.S. House approved a banking act prohibiting federal regulators from interfering with financial institutions that provide services to legal cannabis businesses. A similar measure has been filed in the U.S. Senate. Our next story is not about Illinois, but it could be. In fact, it could be about many rural areas of the country. It's a story about someone, in this case a Washington Post reporter, learning more about a place he wrote about, but didn't really know. The reporter called a county in northwest Minnesota the worst place, then it saved him. John Inger explains.
Let's take a moment to remember how Chris Ingram ended up in the tiny northern Minnesota town of Red Lake Falls. He wrote a story for the Washington Post in 2015, ranking every county in America by scenery and climate. He used data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Hills were good, lakes were good, frigid winters were bad. Based on these measures, Red Lake County, which has no lakes, precious few hills, and winters that reach 40 below, was rated the worst place to live in America. This was the USDA's conclusion, backed by science. Ingram just wrote about it very sparingly.
My beat is data, right? Like, my ideal story is just like one or two charts and maybe one sentence that says, hey, check this out, this is cool.
That didn't stop Minnesotans from taking the story personally. There was a Twitter outcry. Politicians got involved. The townsfolk of Red Lake Falls invited Ingram for a visit to show him just how wrong he'd been. Ingram went and liked it so well he uprooted his family and moved there. That's the short version. Ingram goes into depth in his newly released book, If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now. I met Ingram at his house in Red Lake Falls earlier this summer. His wife Brianna and three kids were at t-ball practice, so the house was quiet. He padded around in his stocking feet and fed roaches to his pet lizard.
Yeah, no, it sounds crazy, right? I mean, I understand that it sounds like a crazy person with a bin of roaches in my living room.
Ingram has lived in Red Lake Falls for 3 years. The book focuses on his first year in town. The first few chapters were simple enough. Ingram was at the end of his rope in Baltimore. The DC commute was terrible. His house was small, his bills were high. He was taking antidepressants and blood pressure medication. He'd just visited Red Lake Falls and was surprised how much he liked it. He began to see a drastic move to rural Minnesota as a way out. But after the move, Ingram says he found it difficult to nail down a compelling narrative arc. People have been nice to him. That's great on a personal level, but bad for writing. If Red Lake Falls really was the worst place to live in America, he says the book would have written itself. But Ingram realized he wasn't just writing about quirky townsfolk. He was writing about his friends.
You know, the thing I was really worried about was, like, the reaction from the people in town. Like, were they going to think that we were just coming out here to, like, exploit them for a story or whatever?
So far, his friends have liked the book. But Ingram was right to worry. A lot of people really did think he was just exploiting rural Minnesotans for a story. Full disclosure, I was one of those people. When it came out that an East Coast data reporter was moving to Red Lake Falls, just 80 miles from my home in Bemidji, my friends and I laid bets on how long he'd last. My bet? 1 year. Or as long as it took him to write a hilarious book mocking the whole region. When I arrived at his house this summer, I expected to see a moving truck parked out front, but that's not Ingram.
This is home now. This is where we live. We've lived longer here than we have just about any other place now. And for my kids, this is the only place they really know. They don't remember much of Baltimore. I mean, Brianna is on the city council now, so she's like, you know, part of the fabric of the community.
The book is kind to Red Lake Falls. There are, however, a few lines that might get Ingram in another round of trouble with Minnesotans. He called walleye an adequate fish. And lefse?
Lefse's okay. I mean, it's bread. It's just bread. It's flatbread. You know, okay, put some butter and sugar on it, and yes, it's going to taste good. Yeah, I'm gonna get tarred and feathered for it, I know, but I had to speak my truth.
Lefse is just okay? In Minnesota, those are fighting words. John Enger, Red Lake Falls.
That wraps up this week's Statewide. All of our episodes, including this one, are available at statewideshow.com. You can find our podcast through the NPR One app. We'll be back at this time again next week. Join us then. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois. We bring you reports and conversations each week, and we couldn't do it without the help of other Illinois public radio stations.